Well,
you were put into from originally that it sounds like you went in and you were only in the training part yourself for a short period.
Well, I learned very fast. Uh-huh. You know, it became child's play for me, and I got very bored. But I learned fast. Mm-hmm. It's just simply a matter of if you needed an employee, if you say you needed a secretary, and you brought her in for one day, and you dictated to her, and you asked her to answer the telephone and take phone calls and maybe write a couple of letters, you'd know within a few hours whether she knew about what she was doing or not. Or if you had hired someone as a shoe salesman, and they put a size 5 on a 10 foot, you'd know almost immediately that they don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the way I was the first day there, or the first, say, half a day. I couldn't wait for the break, the whistle to blow. I mean, I couldn't wait to get out of there. But to this very day, I'm the same way, Jan. Show me something. Go through it with me. Show it to me. And I'll tell you right now, I can do it or I cannot do it. Mm-hmm. Give me a set of mathematical figures or a set of really difficult, anything to do with math, and I'll say to you, I'm sorry that I cannot do it. There's no point in my even trying. But give me something to do, and if I can do it, show me once, and you've got it, mm-hmm. You see? And it was the same then in the gas station. I learned very quickly. They showed me how to check oil, how to check the battery, how to pump the gas, and it was simple. In one watching, I did it. Mm-hmm. Same thing there. But I had men instructors, mm-hmm.
And the instructors had all been white men?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. They were all white and men of service age, although toward the end there remained a couple of young ones, plus most of them were more in their 40s and 50s. But when I first went in, there was a very few women and a very lot of men, and one by one they disappeared. Mm-hmm. I'd have a group leader one day, and the next day, or two or three days later, I'd come back and he was gone. Lead man. Two or three days later, he was gone. There were men in the tool cribs, and one by one, they disappeared. So this is what happened, actually, as they recruited more and more women. They pulled, men had deferments, I think they're called, or deferred, they had deferred classifications. There were some 4Fs. Those are the ones that really actually remained to work. But even the women, a lot of the young women working would disappear day by day going into the service. Mm-hmm. Or they'd go into, well, most of the women in the service that I met, made friends with 4 or 5 girls, mm-hmm. that became WACs and WAVES, and the nurse, for example, in the first aid station went into the service from Vega. So it was very difficult to make friends. It was not more difficult to keep friends because they came and they went so fast. But getting back to by late 42, we had very few men left and almost all women. Sometime in that period, I was sent over to the bench, to the work area or the training area, which was actually at the far end of the huge plant that, as you would, from the bench, you could look over and see the hulls and the bodies of the planes. And the first day I went there, I picked to train. I picked a young man who was 19 years old. I can't remember his name, full name, but today he's a musician because I see him on TV a lot. He's a popular musician with orchestras. And 4 or 5 blacks. Men and women, mm-hmm. both. I worked with them the first day, the second day, the third day. They just couldn't get it. They just, Stan would fall, Stan, that's his name. And one day you'll be watching a show or a play or on television, and you'll see an orchestra, popular like Les Brown, and you'll see a red-headed musician, and that's him. Mm-hmm. He was 19. I think I was 17. Mm-hmm. He'd fall asleep. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't work. He'd say, oh, yeah, I got it now, I got it. And he'd fall asleep. The blacks, they couldn't learn. I'm sorry to say they just couldn't learn. No matter how you showed them, and the body odors were so offensive to me. We all perspired a lot. We all had just wringing wet, soaking wet with sweat all the time because of the heat, the noise, the lights, the heat mostly. But I gave up 2 or 3 times because I'd have to work so close to them. But they just couldn't learn. I don't think they ever learned, really. Some of them did go on to work. They went into the tool cribs and they went into the... A lot of them did work on the assembly lines too, but in my opinion, they just couldn't learn because I gave up. I went to my group leader and I said, I'm quitting. I have to either transfer or I'm quitting. I just can't work in this close proximity and I can't teach them and they won't learn. And then when I would go into Buck and actually work with them, I mean, I'd be on the inside and the holes. I mean, there was no way they couldn't get it because in the beginning, until they learned, there were even strips and lines drawn for them. They just couldn't get it. So I transferred, and I got out of that assembly, and I went into final assembly, thank God, or I would never have stayed. But when I went to quit, they said, well, you know, if you quit, you can't get another job because you don't have you have to have an availability slip. And so I asked to transfer, and then I transferred to the other end of the department, which to me seemed like, oh boy, I've really got it made now. Only it was just as bad or worse, in a sense that the heat and my getting up in those wings and I used to carry a crawl light with me, and I'd lay up there and I'd wait for my worker or my partner on the outside. I'm inside, and I have no way of knowing what's going on outside. And I'd have to get out and crawl, crawl my way out of the wing section. By the wing section, I'm talking about the very tips of the wings. And I'd crawl up in there with a crawl light and lay there waiting for my partner to either, I would be bucking or stripping or putting the strips in and be waiting for them. And I can't tell you how many times I'd lay there and a drill or something would come through and nick me on the leg. Carelessness on the outside part. Because I'm up there and they missed the mark. But 2 or 3 of my very vivid experiences is climbing out of the wings of those planes, sweating and hot and dirty in my eyes, trying to get I shouldn't do that, I've got mascara on, get the sweat out of my eyes and my goggles, you know, and I'd get and crawl down and walk down and get down there and find whoever, or up on the platform and find whoever is supposed to be working with me, sound asleep, and I'd give them a good kick in the ass. And Stan and I worked together, for quite a while, and I just gave up on him. But many a time I've come down and I've kicked him in the butt to wake him up because I've been laying up there waiting for him to start to work. And the blacks were quite notorious for napping too. And they'd get up in the planes, and they'd just sock out. But then I transferred again, and I went into the wiring and the cockpit section, and I loved it. But sometime during all this working in those planes and with that chemical and with the metals, I got a disease, skin disease. And it started out just, you know, this is not it. That's a burn scar. But I got some kind of a metal disease, and it started just about right here where that burn scar is.
Maybe about 3 inches back of your nose.
Uh-huh, and it was never diagnosed as psoriasis, but some years later I saw a girl one time who had a patch on her elbow and on her knees, and I said, what's that? What have you got? She said, well, that's psoriasis. And I said, well, gee, I think I had that one time, but it wasn't psoriasis. But it started out like a psoriasis patch, and it scaled, and I scratched, and I got it on my arms, my neck, my face, places where I was exposed. And I went to doctor after doctor after doctor, and it eventually spread. It started face, neck, arms, hands. And I pretty well covered up at work. you know, or as I wear long sleeves, but then when I get up in there, I'd unbutton them and push them up like this. But it didn't spread to my rest of my body until some months later. But it just looked, they never did tell me what it was. I only know what I did for it. But after it started to spread and it got so bad that I was just clawing myself, I quit. I left. But before that, by the time I left aircraft, which must have been the end of 43, or maybe even, no, part of 44, because I was still working. I transferred over to Lockheed to an easier job after I got the skin infection. There were almost very few men, almost no men left at all. But there were a lot of women, a lot of blacks. I don't seem to remember too many Mexicans working. In fact, I don't remember working with any Mexicans at all. But I did work with a lot of women, and most of the men were either much older, and there were some older blacks, and there were some very young men. But the worst offender of all was that Stan, and men like him, the young boys that would go in, he was classified as 4F right away, wore glasses, and he worked on the outside, because he couldn't handle the inside work, I guess, with glasses. But there was something wrong with most of the men, bless their hearts, that stayed and worked. It was, if you asked, or if there was one we called PB, and I'm not going to tell you what that means, but we had a nickname for him, PB. And he was a little, I think, one arm was, he was, but that isn't why we called him PB. That's a very dirty expression. Turn it off and I'll tell you. speaking of PB, he was in the tour crib, and he had a paralysis, a partial paralysis of one hand, but he was really fast with that other hand. You'd hand him your tool crib token, and he'd issue that tool that you needed right away. There was nothing wrong with him there. But socially, he was unacceptable. So,
to backtrack a little bit, the things that you talked about here at Vega and Lockheed, let's say we go to the beginning. When you first applied, did you have any idea of what the type of work would be that you'd be doing?
No. Mm-mm. No, they just help wanted. I can't remember. They may have specified tool dye workers. I'm sure they did. Tool crib, assembly workers. I think most of the ads were for assembly workers. Mm-hmm. Win the war, do your part, be patriotic, blah, 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 you know. Actually, this is what attracted me to it. It was not the money, and it was not the jobs, because I didn't even know how much money I was going to make. First of all, I had really no conception of what money was, except that you needed a nickel to buy an ice cream or a candy bar, and you needed X amount of money to buy a dress, or of course I never really bought clothes because I always wore hand-me-downs. But I did one time buy a watch for $2, and I paid it off at a quarter a week. So I had an idea, and I suppose I must have had some conception of it, because I used to work and get money, and I knew how to get my 15 cents out of 50 cents. So I knew, really. But to handle a sum of money, or to handle a paycheck that, like the first paycheck I got from working in aircraft, it was more money than I'd ever seen in my life. I didn't even know what to do with it. When I got 16 a week, I knew I had to pay $2 for my rent and 50 cents a week on the sweater I bought in layaway, and I had to have so much for food. So I knew how to handle a little money. But we jumped from $16 a week up to, I don't even remember what the salaries were, but it was more than I'd ever seen in my life. But the ads and it had to be bombardment, that's all I can say. On the radios, on the billboards, on the street corners, plastered on the store windows, do your part, Uncle Sam needs you, V for victory. My idea of going to work in aircraft, truthfully, was not the money, was not the job, because at that time I was having people approach me 6 and 8 and 10 times a day where I worked. Come to work for me. I could use you. Come to work for me. RCA Victor wanted me to come to work for them. Technicolor said, listen, we'll train you. Come to work for us. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a question of a job, mm-hmm. because from absolutely nothing, within 3 weeks of coming to California, it was just like my mind was dazzled with all the offers I had. But I got caught up in that patriotic win the war, help the boys, somebody's listening. The patriotism that was so strong in everyone then. And when I wrote to my dad for my birth certificate, he wrote back, don't do it, don't go to war. I mean, don't go into the war. I also said to him, when I'm old enough, I want to go into service, and absolutely not. Don't do anything, don't have anything to do with war, don't have anything to do with soldiers. There was a good reason for that, too. But I think we discussed that in my early childhood. But at my age, and I'm, mind you, I'm 16 and a half and 17, I am now going into bars and I'm drinking. One of my favorites was the Jade on Hollywood Boulevard. Another was the merry-go-round on Vine Street, and when Nat King Cole sat at the piano and sang, and he was not even known, a nobody, and the piano bar went round. This is long before I ever reached 18 or even 21. I was just like the rest of the workers. I worked first 3 to 11, I think, 3 to 11. We got out 12 o'clock. You could have, you know, there were blackouts, no place to go except little bars. I worked the swing at first, and then later I transferred to the graveyard shift so that I could work two jobs. Mm-hmm. Not because of the money, but because there was nothing to do, and I was restless, and I was discouraged, and toward the end I saw the futility. First of all, I was too conscientious. I was so, you know, we got to get in there, we got to produce, we got to get these planes out. And a lot of people felt that way. We got to keep them rolling, we got to get these guns, well, not guns, but in, you know, for example, you go to a movie, and then the break in the movie would be something patriotic, workers win, you know, do your share. And I was very impressionable. But after a few months of working with other people, and they'd say, oh, what the hell's the rush? Yeah, the war's going to go on. Why hurry it? So what if we don't do a day's? We were supposed to do so much every day. I'd say, why push it? You're going to get paid anyway. I mean, or it's too hard work. The work was hard. It was hot. It was dirty. It was noisy. The noise was enough to kill anybody. The noise and the sweat. We used to go to the water coolers for salt tablets every hour. Then as it went on and on and on into it, everything slowed down. You'd stand at the tool crib for 20 minutes to turn in your tool, or you'd stand in line to get your tool. And then when you would be late, or some of them would go to the water cooler and they wouldn't come back, and you'd be waiting. And then they'd say to you, what the hell's the rush? The war's going to go on. Don't worry about it. We'll win the war. You know, what's to worry? What's to worry? This is their attitude. Not all, but some of them. And I think maybe toward the end, I just said, hey, you know, this, I can only just do so much. I became very frustrated, inasmuch as I thought, because I'd been conditioned to do what the boss told me, the work syndrome, you got to work, no eat, you know, you work for your pay. This was drilled into me from the time I was very small. My dad, you know, if you don't work, you don't eat, you know, and things, these are the things that were harmful in my growing up days. But when I got around these people that had been born in the cities and came from the woodwork, as we call them, and we had a lot of by this time, Okies, Arkies, people were coming in from the hills. They were coming from women that had never worked before, coming out of their homes to work. And they were patriotic in the beginning. I think most women were. when they really came, say, from a quiet household into a noisy defense plant. Mm-hmm. But I believe most of them in the beginning were really inspired by the patriotic, the thought. And of myself, I had brothers in the service. Leroy was in the Navy, and he was later hurt. He was in the Persian Gulf when their plane, or not their plane, their ship was torpedoed. And he spent, you know, he was hurt. Then David was, my brother David was in the Army. And I had numerous cousins and boyfriends, one by one. You know, the boyfriends that I would go with. I'd meet someone and we'd go out a few times, gone, service. Several of them got killed. And I'd hear this, and then I'd say, well, we've got to do it, we've got to do it, we've got to work. We've got to get these planes out. But it seemed to me like I was one, and I'm working with all these little ants that are just crawling around. And if you would stand up on a platform and look down, and the people, you know, working on the bottom just seemed like they were little, you know, it's your perspective is very different when you're up and inside and you're hot, and you're it's noisy and you have no air, and you're, the higher up you are, the hotter it is because of those lights overhead. But I don't think the patriotism, maybe the patriotism lasted, but I don't think the enthusiasm lasted very long. I think toward the end, women simply did it because out of, we knew we had to do it. I began to see boys coming back. One fellow I knew, a young man I'd met and gone with, in 1944, I lived on Van Ness Avenue many, many years, and then I walked in those days because I didn't have a car. Got off the bus and I'm walking home and I hear this tap, 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 and I turn around and I look and I thought, gee, sir, soldier in uniform with the tapping, and I turn back around again and I said, my God, it's Dick. Still in uniform, come home blind. And that was my first shock. The very first shock. I had known Dick. I met him when I first came here. And he, during the time I knew him, and while I was working, he went to the service. In fact, I left an old car in front of the rooming house I lived in, and I tried to fix it up, and I never could. I couldn't get tires for it. And that was my first shock, seeing him come back and blind. And he was still in uniform. And he was tapping his way along on Van Ness to find where he lived. Or not to find, but he could see very little. But he had a cane. He later became totally blind. And Dick was 22 years old. There were two or three other fellows that I had known from the bowling alley. And from, you know, I went with young people my age. And it wasn't, they weren't hard to meet at all. Because, like today, young people meet young people, and we had meeting places. And when I began to see them coming back, it really did something to me. But I left aircraft because of a skin disease, and that was really something. It took about 6 months out of my life that I'll never forget, and I still don't know what it was.
Mm-hmm. So, when you had... First down in there, they hadn't really told you what
kind of
you were going to do.
No, I was just hired for the assembly line. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Had you ever worn pants before?
No. Uh-huh. No, we didn't wear pants then.
Did you remember, I know that for the
war work,
did you have to then go out and buy special clothes to work in the plant?
No, I already had something to wear. When I was recruited for Krieger Oil Company, they made me a jumpsuit, which was absolutely stunning. In fact, I showed you a picture of me in it one day, or I think I did. They sent me to a tailor, and in like one day's time, I had a jumpsuit made. And it was in khaki, and it was really beautiful. And today, they're very popular. Only mine was made of, I suppose, a gabardine or a cotton, wool cotton, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first went in, I wore that, but we then went into, I bought boys' blue jeans. And just plaid shirts, heavy. I bought heavy shirts because the nicks, scratches, I was just scarred from, my arms were scarred from work, my face was scarred, I had scars all over me from scratches and, you know, we worked with raw metal.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually raw aluminum, and we worked with drills. And we worked with tools. Later on, I worked with pliers and cutting pliers, cutting wires, and screws and rough edges. And, you know, it was more to it than just holding a bar and shooting a drill. I mean, you didn't just, the bucker inside, I think, I can't remember, but it's some kind of a bar and then the drill. And it seems easy, and it really was easy for me, but it was more than that, than just making a, you had to have the right space between the rivets, and you had to have the right section, and I can't actually remember all of it. To me, it was easy, but I suppose looking back now that the blacks had never really been out in the world, and they'd never really been exposed to work like that, and I didn't have too many women blacks. There were mostly men blacks that I worked with in 16. I don't know why, but we had some women at first, and they're the ones who stayed, by the way. They're the ones that ended up there, because I believe probably the blacks were either called into the service or they went into better jobs or somewhere else. I don't know. But there weren't too many young white men, just a few, and they were the worst.
Now, when you came in there, though, you said that when you first went to work, they mm-hmm. were mainly men.
Mostly men.
How did they seem to react to women being in the plant?
Well, there were a few catcalls, and we had a lot of fun, and then we worked. I mean, we had breaks, free time. I think we had to go outside the plant for lunch, and I used to take my lunch. I don't know how other people managed it, but I would take a lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go outside to eat. Then we'd socialize. Oh, we'd socialize in line at the tool crib. As I recall, the whistle would blow 5 minutes, perhaps, maybe, or you'd have a five-minute warning or something where you gathered up your tools. You were responsible for them. To get a tool, you gave a token. To get the tool, get the token back, you took the tool back. A lot of them were very careless and lazy. I saw things left lying around that, you know, they'd just go off and leave them. They didn't care. They had no sense of responsibility. They just didn't care. Those probably are the people that didn't last or didn't stay in that department because they would come and go. And that, after all, in the beginning, they were only there to train on the first, you might say the first trainer, before they moved further and further into the plant and into the regular assembly lines. But this first assembly line was like first grader for beginners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my experience came with the trying to learn. I learned fast. I was then sent back there at one time to train, and I couldn't do it. They couldn't learn. But
confidence in terms of working with, like, this would be the first time really that you had been working with tools like that. Mm-hmm. Also, did you, were you ever afraid about that, or did you ever feel nervous at all?
Yes, inside, when I'd go up in the wings, I'd be nervous. Handling the drills, and then we were all, you had the main, I've forgotten what it's called, but you had several different sizes of drills.